Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd, live on the Heritage Radio Network. This is your host, Greg Blaze, and we're here with the second installment of our Old School, New School series. Last week, we talked to a couple of producers of cow's milk cheeses in the U.S., and today we'll be talking to two goat cheese makers and getting their input about the state of artisanal American cheese making, both past and present. Representing one of the pioneers of artisanal farmstead goat cheese making is Judy Shad of Capriole Goat Cheese, who's on the line from Greenville, Indiana. How are you today, Judy?
Great, and how are you?
I'm fantastic. We also have Michael Lee on the line. He is the owner and head cheesemaker at Twig Farm in West Cornwall, Vermont, and he will be representing the burgeoning generation of youthful goat cheese makers. Thanks for chatting with us today, Michael, and how are you?
I'm doing pretty well, thanks.
It's good to have you. So here's a question I have for both of you to start off, and it's simple. It's why goats? And Judy, I'm going to ask you to field that one first. Why did you start making goat cheese?
You're making me laugh. I've asked myself that question, why goats, many times, and I never really came up with a wonderful answer except that I like them. And I liked the cheese because the disadvantages are many. I think you have to really love the animal, you have to love the milk they produce, and you have to love the cheeses that you make from that milk in order to do it, because it's not easy. So I fell into it, 35 years ago as a 4-H project for my children, and pretty soon goats multiply very quickly, to have twins and triplets, and so I'm swimming in milk, and I've got, you know, city kids, because we've moved to the country from the city, who don't want to drink the milk no matter how you disguise it.
And, sure.
And I discovered, French cheeses, and then cheeses from Letty Kilmoyer at Westfield Farm, and
yeah.
I fell in love, and I thought, well, this is why there's goat milk.
So you met Letty. You went to the Westfield Farms to purchase cheese, or you met her at a? How did you come to meet Miss Kilmoyer?
Well, first I met Ricky Carroll, the mother of us all, who wrote her little Cheese Making Made Easy book, which we all learned to make cheese from in our kitchens,
and myself included.
She had introduced me to Letty and several others. And so I wanted to taste these cheeses, which were, of course, so much better than mine because I knew nothing. And that was how it all began. And Letty let me come and spend some time with her and make cheese. And so I decided I could do this. And
interestingly enough, I know the Kilmoyers myself. I think I visited that farm because it's very, very close to where I grew up when I was about 10 years old, and I'm pretty sure I served them ice cream at the store that I worked at, which was the first job I've ever worked. But that was a long, long time ago. So I guess I'm old school too, or
I'm so glad someone is.
So Michael, I wanted to ask you the same question. Why goats? Why were you drawn to making goat's milk cheese?
I think a little bit of echoing of what Judy just said. I like them. I think I wouldn't be still doing it 10 years later if I didn't like them.
Absolutely.
But the reason why I think kind of is framed by a decision that I wanted to farm, and I wanted to farm in a particular place in Vermont where it seemed to me there were a lot of farms around that were milking cows and doing it pretty well, and in some ways they had spoken for most of the best agricultural land, and the land that I had was very ledgy and not exactly suitable for cows. I could have worked with sheep, but I'd had experience working with sheep, and I think I'd had enough experience working with
sheep. Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and so I said, well, let's check out goats, and I've enjoyed goats. I like the scale that they are. Working with them, relate to them very much as a person to an animal. I don't know. I enjoy that, and I love the cheese that you can make with their milk.
But both of you guys have said the same thing. So why, if I can follow up, why do you like goats so much? What in goats do you see, I guess, in yourselves? Judy.
They're interesting personalities, aren't they?
Well, they are in my experience meeting them, but I want to ask you, Judy, and, why are you guys like goats? I don't know.
Well, I think, you know, if you let them, they would sit in your lap. For
really?
One thing, they'd, you know, eat at the dining room table with you or stand on top of it. And I do believe that for people who don't come from a firm farm background, you know, where you probably wouldn't do anything that silly, they are just charming. And the personalities are so individual, and they're your friends. They're easy to bond with, unlike sheep. I'm sure you'd probably echo that too, correct?
Michael, is that true?
Definitely. Easy to bond with. They're the most personable of livestock that I've ever had the pleasure to work with, and that's a good, and sometimes it's a complicating factor, because it's you are still a farmer, and you still have to make decisions about them based on more than just your feelings.
Absolutely. Well, there's that. I mean, and obviously, you mentioned that you enjoyed the scale. Is that something that you consider the amount of milk and the amount of animals that you'd have to handle?
Well, I was thinking more of the scale of a goat being, a mature our mature milking goats are about 130 pounds.
Uh-huh.
It's a size I can relate to. I mean, I'm,
sure.
I'm larger than that, but my wife's not. So,
sure.
It's that, I guess, and the fact that you have to be gentle in a way with them, because they you could overwhelm them in a way that you couldn't with a cow, for instance.
You could scare
body,
them.
You know, so I think that it provokes a different response in me, I guess.
Is that the same for you, Judy?
Yeah, I think. They have very long memories, and if they're not treated well, they remember. We had people here off and on who we let go for that reason, because the personalities didn't mesh
with the animals
at all. They were they did try to treat them, I suppose, if they'd worked on dairy farms and they'd worked with cows, which were a little harder to move and handle. Sometimes they goats just don't respond to that, and they do respond, most of them do respond to gentleness, but I think all of us who have had them would find that we select we select animals on that basis too. You know, we tend to have animals in our herds. We keep those offspring whose mothers, work well in that kind of an environment. They are hard. I had a friend one time who had said who had goats forever, and she said in some ways goats are their worst enemies, because it's very hard to make decisions on who stays and who goes,
right?
Because you love them all,
well,
and that's difficult.
Well, also, I was wanted to go to the nuts and bolts of what you do. Are both of you are breed specific. I know, Michael, you have Alpine goats, and you have a couple of Saanens and a Nubian. Is that it?
Well,
is that...
I used to. They're pretty much. I've just got Alpines at this point. There's, I guess, there's one Saanen cross left, and you know, she's about 8 years old, so she's probably not going to be with us that much longer. But the rest are Alpines.
And are those, did you choose those goats, or do they give you a particular, they work with the terrain well, and they help you make the kind of cheese you like to make?
You know, I'd like to say that those, you know, those sound like great reasons, but the first and foremost reason was probably aesthetics.
Really?
Yeah, you know, mm-hmm. I was looking, I said, I want brown goats, and
I was obsessed with
what I could find.
Well, Judy, you have the same type of, you have the same mix, right? You have the
yes. Yeah, we started with an Alpine herd, and, you know, the children showed them, and I fell in love with them. And then, of course, I'm the same. We call those brown ones chamoisé.
Okay.
And they're the most French, don't you think, of all the goats?
Yeah.
You know, I love those brown goats with the black dorsal stripes. But I think beyond that, I found them to be the hardiest of the breeds. They're a little more aggressive than some of the other breeds, and they tend to be, if you have 10, 11-year-old animals in your herd, they're usually going to be Alpine.
Right. They're the toughest. They can tough it out
long.
They're
tough, yes.
Well, that's interesting, because I find that as a purchaser of your cheese a long time, you make cheeses that remind me a lot of some French cheeses that I bought, and so your goats are French, and your cheeses are, to me, obviously, as well.
Gee, we hope so.
But they're also very distinctly yours. But I was wondering if, you know, if when you began, because I know you work in a different spot than Michael is. You drop down into, into 30 minutes from Louisville, Kentucky, and to a place that mm-hmm. I'm not sure maybe had those type mm-hmm. of cheeses around before.
Right.
And you've stuck with the same type of cheese. You know, your recipes are known, and your cheeses are known. I was wondering if that was what led you to make that decision.
Well, you know, the terrain thing's an interesting question. We live in an area called Kentuckiana, which really means nowhere.
Okay,
we're not really Kentucky. We kind of fell off the end of the state in Indiana, but it's very similar kind of terrain. It's limestone. It's rocky. It's hill country. In the hills above the river, and except for the weather, which is, you know, tends to be not quite as cold as in the wintertime, it's very similar, and it's kind of bourbon country. You know, it's that limestone thing. Water's important here, but I think that those were the cheeses that I'm passionate about. Those were the cheeses, those ripened goats were the ones that I fell in love with.
Those are the ones that you like.
I love them. I don't make anything. Well, I do make a few things I'm not crazy about. But but I love those. I call them the girls.
The girls.
Because I think they're lady cheeses.
Oh.
And they're delicate, and they just rock my world.
Well, nice. Getting your world rocked is great. Michael, you make a very different type of cheese than Judy does. And what inspired you to make the kinds of cheese that you make in Vermont?
There are a couple of things, I guess, that you could say inspired or pointed me in that direction. One, I had a desire, and it's not an ideological desire. It was just a desire to make raw milk cheeses. And it seemed not very feasible to make a lactic mold-ripened cheese out of raw milk and sell it commercially. So I
understand that.
And so I just kind of started. I was working at a cheese shop, and I kind of just explored all of the possibilities, and I kind of really enjoyed some of the goat's milk and mixed milk and cheeses from both Piedmont and Savoie. And
yes, sorry.
And that's where the inspiration came from. And I said, I think I can make cheeses like that with goat's milk. And that's, you know, that's what I set out to do.
That was when you were at Formaggio?
And
you were eating Percier and things like that. Where I always thought that's
Percier,
what the
Percier de Tignes.
Yeah,
and then just all the sort of little obscure atomas from Piedmont as well. It's just, those things. I looked into how you would make perseidotine, and I said, geez, I don't think I could do that because I'd have to make cheese every day. And
yes, you would.
Be me.
Yes, you would.
So I said, well, I'll see if there's some other cheeses. And so, I just kind of dug around. And then when I got access to milk, I just kind of played with it.
Now, Judy, you guys switched from raw to pasteurized.
Right.
And then why exactly did you do that? What made you switch?
I was just as passionate about the raw milk cheeses.
Of course, of course.
At that point too, but I wasn't doing the style of aged cheeses that you're doing at Twig. One of the huge issues with goat milk, and I don't want to belabor this point, is that it takes 6 or 7 times the amount of animals to get the same amount of milk you're getting out of a cow.
Sure.
Which is, explains the expense of those cheeses, but it also explains the expense of the production of those cheeses as well. And so we wanted a higher moisture cheese, and those are a little more finicky in terms of safety issues. So for 10 and 12 years, we did make them from raw milk. And then I think it was a number of things. I became more and more concerned about the safety factors. And we did more and more testing. And it got to the point where we were testing for, every batch, for everything all the time.
That's a lot of work.
It was a lot of work, and it was lab work. So that became, that contributed to the expense of the cheese. So,
Michael, do you have that same thing that goes on? Do you have to because you make only raw milk cheese, do you find that you have to test all the time?
We test frequently. We don't test every batch for everything, but we do have a regular testing program, and it definitely adds to the expense of the cheese. A battery of tests on any one batch of milk is going to be at least $30. And
sure.
If the size of the batch is about 30 pieces of cheese, well, that's another dollar for each piece of cheese.
Judy, when exactly did you decide to switch from raw to pasteurized?
We did this about 2 years ago, and that was also at the time when there there was a lot of scrutiny on these cheeses. And we felt, I think that one of the biggest factors, Michael, is that your cheeses are hard cheeses.
Sure.
Yeah.
Ours have a pretty high moisture content. What sort of yield, for instance, what percentage milk to cheese do you get?
What kind of yield am I getting? Right now they're on pasture, and it is, it's awful. Green cheese, I think we're lucky if we get 11%.
Yeah.
That's low.
And so our percentage would be a little bit higher on ours. And, ours kind of stay softer and get a little runny. They're a hybrid. They don't really fit in any real category.
Yeah, I mean, that yield for ours is, we'll lose another 25 to 28% in the aging process on our cheeses.
Right. So that's big, and I think when you're dealing with a milk that is expensive to produce, at the time we sort of started doing that to absorb the spring milk supply beyond the fresh cheeses, when the flush came in, that was when we were making
a lot of
our
cheese.
Aged cheeses, right? Yeah,
absolutely. Those are extremely extremely interesting points. I think it's interesting to me for me to note that. I wonder, Michael, if you'll ever get to a point where you feel you need to pasteurize. I mean, I find that whole thing to be quite interesting.
I don't think, if I continue making the cheeses that I'm making, I would feel compelled to pasteurize based on our scale and the amount of testing I do and what I find in our milk now. I think it would probably be a regulatory directive that would force me to pasteurize, and then I would probably rethink the whole operation because it would change the possibilities for the kind of cheese I would make if I were pasteurizing.
Absolutely. I think that's really a valid point. And I think moisture content is a huge, don't you think it's a huge issue as far as safety is concerned?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I mean, there are raw milk cheeses with moisture contents that, you know, that, yeah, they get them to 60 days, but I get a little sketched out about it.
Yeah, of course.
I prefer some of these cheeses were sold younger, you know. It's just what happens with that moisture content over an extended period of time at cool temperatures is, you know, well, it's not anybody's guess. They've seen.
Well,
not necessarily a good thing.
Well, guys, we're going to have to take a short break, but I think it's great that you guys are so engaged with each other about the cheese-making process. So we'll be right back and continue our talk. Thanks so much.
Brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Washed rind cheeses are a fairly recent addition to the repertoires of artisanal cheesemakers in the United States. These cheeses tend to be stinkier than other types and are often high on the list of connoisseurs. Now, Whole Foods Market has come up with one of their own. The Raw Cow's Milk Cheese, made by Sprout Creek Farm in Poughkeepsie, New York, is washed with 6-point ale from Red Hook, Brooklyn. The beige sticky rind deepens in color as it ages. The satiny ivory cheese within is mellow, with a sweetly tangy bite and a grassy aroma. The current version features 6-point diesel, which is in limited supply, so stop by and pick up some before it's gone. And point-of-origin cheese is sold exclusively at Whole Foods Market in New York, northern New Jersey, and Connecticut. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Welcome back to our old school, new school discussion of artisanal goat cheese makers. We're here with Judy Shad and Michael Lee of Capriole and Twig, respectively. I felt bad interrupting you guys, and I think it's fantastic that you were talking, and I just sort of got lost in listening to what you were saying. And I wanted to tell you that led me directly into my next question for both of you. And that was, and I'll start with you, Judy. A sense of community amongst cheesemakers. I wonder, when you started to do this, what was the community of people that you were around that made the cheese, and how did you find the communication between cheesemakers? You know, was your mentor willing to give up the information you wanted? How did you get started, and what was your community like back then?
Well, I think people have always been very there are no secrets. Really. I mean, you know, there's only so many recipes, that basic recipes, and we all give it our own treatment. But so from some points of view, we shared a lot of information. But there were other things that we, you know, there was always a line you didn't cross. But
what line was that?
Well, for instance, when I went to work with Letty, what we made was basic, fresh, the fresh white stuff that everybody thinks of as goat cheese. You know, there's millions of them, but they say, I want the goat cheese. That's what they mean. I think that
that was, she was more than willing to share, and that was the basis of everything else they did. So that was the critical one. But no, we didn't talk about her blue cheeses. We didn't talk about some of the other things they did. Those were theirs. And there was a lot of respect among cheesemakers for that. I think maybe a bit more respect than now.
Really?
When, simply because there's so many more people in the marketplace. So there's bound to be more duplication, bound to be more, you know, things that are very similar. But but we were very careful not to cross those lines of what was rather proprietary. And yet, when we had problems, there was no community to go to.
Right.
There were no schools. There were no experts.
Right.
We had each other. And that was, and I think that formed that initial sense of community among cheesemakers, that we had far more in common than, and the real battle was not among each other. The battle was to get those early goat cheeses into the marketplace, have people have some kind of understanding of acceptance.
You were banded together and fighting against, fighting for
fighting for an awareness of those cheeses in the American marketplace, particularly, because there was, you know, there were a lot of people initially who wouldn't even taste anything made from goat milk. So
there still are, unfortunately. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know where these people come from, but they're out there, because I had a retailer deal with them all the time. It's kind of crazy. But Michael, do you find that it's shifted now that there are many, many makers and there are a lot of duplicates? How did you start out? Were you by yourself, or you were exploring cheese styles by yourself? Who was your mentor for a cheesemaker?
I didn't learn to make cheese on my own. I had the pleasure of working with Ann and Bob Works, who had Peaked Mountain Farm down in Vermont. And they're now retired, and there's actually a nice couple that went to school right around here, is picked up at Big Picture Farm down there. They've got goats and make caramels and are making cheese now,
too. I like goat milk caramels.
Yeah. Ann Worth was very generous. She was, I think I made cheese with her four times, and she said, "I think you've got the hang of it. Why don't you just make it next
Go
time?
Go do it."
I would never do that.
No?
Anybody that works with me. But it was very generous of her, and I learned I had to learn very quickly. As far as duplication of styles, when we started here, we had already met Hannah Sessions and Greg Bernhardt, who had started Blue Ledge Farm, which is about 7 miles from here. And a funny thing, Hannah's coming over to pick up some boxes this afternoon.
Put her on the line, man. We'll talk to her.
if I see her drive in, I will. I called them and said, "Hey, my wife and I are going to be moving to the area, and we're going to start a farm and gonna make goat cheese. But we're not going to make fresh cheese, and we're not going to make mold ripened cheese, which is what they were concentrating on. And they were, you know, they were a little wary at first, which I can understand. But they were also kind of supportive in a funny way. Well,
I find just the cheesemongering community, that sums it up for me, like cautiously supportive. Sometimes I feel like we all are of each other. I don't know why that just struck a chord with me.
You
know, can I ask you a point of question? Do you feel that there are sometimes, and I don't think I have an opinion on this one way or another, but do you think that there are many, many cheesemakers, sometimes too many cheesemakers, or can there never be enough cheesemakers in the new
school? No, I think there's never enough cheesemakers.
Yeah,
that's great.
Do you agree, Michael?
I agree. I think the first time I met you was at Slow, Judy, was at Slow Cheese in Bra, and it was like 2003 or something like that.
Yeah.
And that was, to me, such a revelation, like the density of cheesemakers from Piedmont. I was thinking, how large is Piedmont? How many hundreds of people make cheese here? My God.
As a veteran of bra, I can attest to that. And then last year it was so big, I actually couldn't get down some streets in there.
Oh, my God. You know, I do remember, Michael, I remember meeting you there. And it that was one of the amazing places that for such a big world, it's also such a small one. And you could go around the corner and there were the guys from Neil's Yard, and you said hello just as you were walking down the street, and then you went down a little bit further, and there was an Irish cheesemaker, and then there were the French guys that you'd met, and blah, blah, blah. And so it was, it's still in some ways a very small world, and I think there's a really strong sense of community. I still, when I have a real question, I still call Allison at Vermont Butter and Cheese, or I call Mary at Cypress Grove.
You call your people, you know.
We call our peeps, and they call us.
That's
so
fantastic.
I think not quite so much as we used to. But, you know, when we began, I don't know how Michael feels about it, but I always felt like it was kind of just cooking, you know.
Do you feel that way?
It was like what you did in your kitchen. I mean, it was. It's still here, very much hands-on, touchy-feely, smell it, taste it, look at it, touch it.
I had a fella come in this morning. He came and he shadowed me from about 5:15 until about 10:30. And so I was reminded, because he was taking pictures the whole time for this Instagram thing for Smithsonian.
I like that.
Instagram.
I had to ask him how it works.
Oh, man.
How's that for new school?
That's
right?
Not very new school of you, man. I don't know.
But it reminded me of just, you know, he's like, so how do you, you know, he's just asking questions like, well, and he mentioned the idiosyncratic way I seem to be going about doing things. And I was like, well, I do all of these things just so I can get it the same.
Yeah, of course.
And, it's just the way, you know, it's like, it is kind of like cooking. You're trying to come up with this thing, and you've got to respond to what's happening in front of you. And I don't know.
Your egg whites are going to behave differently in your meringue if it's humid outside or if it's not humid. I mean, the same things apply in so many ways to the cheese. And I think one of the huge things with goat milk was because those weren't traditional cheeses in the U.S., and they were in Europe, we used to talk about the fact that in France, for instance, they knew exactly when the milk was going to change, and they knew what to do to adjust their cheese making to the differences in the milk. And we had to learn that, you know, over a period of time. We threw so much cheese away.
Well, in a certain way, I guess all of us here in America are a little new school, even the old school amongst us.
Exactly. But it just didn't take us 600 years to
do that. We're Americans. We try to get things done pretty quick. Look, I got one more question for you guys, because we're going to have to go in a second. And I wish I had like a lot more, you know, I wish I had like a, I've really enjoyed talking to you guys. And now my question is, what is the future for both of you and your operations? I asked this to Franklin Peluso and to Jos Volto. Is there a difference between the old school and the new school? As far as family goes, Judy, what's going to happen when you, God forbid, you don't make the cheese over there anymore? Who's going to do it for you?
Oh, good God. You know, Letty asked me this 15, 20 years ago. Okay, you got yourself into this. Now how are you going to get out? And I still really don't have an answer. But what I do have here are a core of wonderful all guys, about four of them that I work with, and increasingly it's becoming their thing. They're passionate about it. They think about the cheese first. They know that I'm a perfectionist, and they hopefully are too, and you have to be with these very fragile cheeses. They love it. So I'm hoping that, you know, they become the new face. I'll go on until I have to crawl over there. But
Franklin said the same thing to me. It was interesting.
Did he?
Yeah, he did. And Jos, Yost said something different to me, but Franklin said almost the same thing as you. His son was set up to take over, but it sounds like you have a surrogate family of dudes. You said that are
dudes. I love the dudes.
Love the dudes. and Michael, what about you? What's the long view for the Twig Farm? Is it any different from Judy's?
The long view is, it's very hazy, to be honest.
It's very hazy.
Too many trees in the way. I think, you know, I'll keep at this for as long as I enjoy it. And then if my son wants to, well, he's welcome to, but he hasn't really shown much interest. He's only 8, so it's not likely he would show much interest.
Right.
I just kind of keep going. I'm planting a bunch of apple trees, and those take a long time to mature. And,
yeah, they do.
I'll be here.
Well, I wanted to say, thank you to both of you guys for coming on and being a part of this this little series. I feel like we learned 3 things today. We learned 1 that goat cheesemakers really like goats, and we also learned that there can never be enough cheesemakers. Ever, which I think is a cool thing. And what I personally learned is that even though the old school and the new school are different, they operate by the same principles, and that's fantastic.
And we like each other.
Yeah, I think that's great. So thank you so much, and thanks, guys, for listening to another episode of Cutting the Curd, live on the Heritage Radio Network, and we'll be back next week with more. Take care.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.